Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Richard Donner's 1987 film Lethal Weapon. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Hey, Ben. Happy January.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
A lot of people say Happy New Year, so I switch it up.
Gotta be the contrarian, always. How was your New Year's, Tyler?
It was good. I did a couple one-man shows out there in Los Angeles. Didn't you come and see me?
No, I missed those. I was back in Florida.
What? I was only there for like 3 weeks.
Oh, man. Must have just missed.
How is that even possible?
Wow. Spoiler alert, it isn't.
Dude, let me tell you something, though, that I think is pretty funny. And I wanted to steal it, but I'm not going to steal it.
Okay.
Scott Aukerman, you may be a personal friend, confidant of him, because you frequent
the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yeah, the Upright Citizens Brigade, and he hosts the Comedy Bang Bang podcast, which I believe used to be called something else. I don't know.
Okay.
Podcast, maybe? I don't know. And he created this new character, or he's coming up with this new character. It's movie critic who has a problem with like the main plot line of a movie.
A problem understanding it?
No, like his criticism, the movie critic's main criticism,
is
like a pivotal plot line in the movie.
Right.
And so like his example was like, you know, I really enjoyed War Horse, but I just didn't understand why the father sold the horse to the army. Like I just didn't get, like, he has a problem with the motivational instance of the film.
Right.
Which I thought was a pretty, you know, mind-blowing character, and somebody we should probably have on for our own podcast.
I hope so.
I think he would give us, no, not Scott Aukerman, just the movie critic, Scott Aukerman as the movie critic who has a problem with the main plot line, and I think we'd get some interesting thoughts out of that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm hoping that maybe one or both of those gentlemen could come on at some point. 2012, I have a feeling, is going to be a good year for us. So we thank our listeners for sticking with us through the new year. And let's kick.
Is there a way to actually get worse before we get better? Let's do that.
I don't know. We'll play that on a.
You down with that?
We'll play that on a week by week basis, Tyler.
Okay.
See how we go. Actually, before we get started, sorry to delay the intro here, but.
Okay.
Since you're giving random shout-outs to podcasts, I was cracking up at a recent episode of the Film Drunk Frotcast, in which Vince Mancini, who's a friend of the show, he's been on a couple times, and the rest of those guys, quote-unquote, interview David Lee Roth. Have you heard that episode, Tyler?
No, I'm going to get back into the Frotcast. I've been taking a hiatus from the Frotdom.
Yes,
and I'm hoping to shave my balls and you know, get some fake Brett back in me and whatnot.
There you go. Yeah, it's hysterical. So
did they do any koi fish prank calls?
They did do some koi calls, and they're pretty awesome. So good stuff. All right. Well, if you guys are just joining us for the first time, we start every episode with the character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our big review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can
We've
find
got
this
both today. We've got
yeah,
both.
Yeah, we do have both.
So listen to the end.
Yeah, definitely. And you guys can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So, Tyler, why don't you...
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm going to be starting the direct download thing for past podcasts. I'm probably going to do the last 20, maybe the last 10. So the 10 most recent, I'll probably do like 10 a week or something.
Okay.
That it shouldn't take too long. So the latest from like, what episode is this? 72?
I think this is 72. Yes.
So from 72 to maybe 60. I'll have that direct download under the podcast tab at notjustnewmovies.com. So if you're listening and you're itching to directly download, I'll have those hopefully this week, and then 60 to 59 through 50 will be, you know,
Right.
You know how it goes.
And so on and so forth, yes. So for the character name game this week, the only movie that came out in theaters this past weekend was a movie called The Devil Inside, which I've heard is just abysmal, and people are literally booing in theaters across the country and demanding money back and stuff. I wasn't planning on seeing it anyway. But
did you see that commercial where the people were watching it in the church?
No. Oh, God.
Yeah, right? That's what I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was bad enough that they're like playing up the fact that the Vatican doesn't enforce this film. It's a film about exorcisms, for those of you who don't
know. Yeah, I think they might say that just to get people in the meat in the seats.
Oh, sure. Yeah, totally. That's what I'm saying. I thought that was a cheap ploy. But
I don't think the Vatican cares a damn bit about what Hollywood's doing.
Yeah, not too much, I would
guess. They're the Vatican. They've got other things to worry about.
Yeah.
But continue. I'm sorry.
So, yeah, basically nobody of any note is in that movie, so our character name game...
Except the devil, of course. Plan. Somewhere inside you.
Lucifer is there. So I'm not sure what movie...
No
Little
props.
Nicky? Little Nicky, maybe, is the movie?
No props to the devil, but apparently he is in this movie.
So, Tyler, you've got the character name game for us this week, and you're going to do it a little differently, yes?
Yeah, I'm going to do it a little differently. We have been skimming the characters, and I found an interesting one that where a character is not described by name, but also but actually a character occupation game. So it's a three-word occupation, and you're going to have to guess which movie this character, who's only described by occupation, which movie he's in.
And this has like some sort of loose tie to a movie that's actually playing in theaters right now, yes?
Loose, very loose.
Okay, great. As per usual, with you, when you run the character name game, it is as loose as can possibly be. But all right, let's get this thing going.
Okay, the occupation is Pootie Tang Imposter.
Wow, okay.
Pootie Tang Imposter.
All right.
I'm going to move that you may want to answer this now if you'd like.
You know what? I'll go ahead and answer it now.
Okay.
I'm gonna guess Pootie Tang.
That is correct, Ben. Nice job.
Okay.
2001's Pootie Tang, starring Chris Rock.
Yep.
J.B. Smoove. And written and directed by Louis C.K. So.
Right.
Pootie Tang Imposter is actually played by David Cross, famous for playing Funke in Arrested Development.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also in Alvin and the Chipmunks Chipwrecked.
Oh, okay. All
right. Which has so far domestically earned $111 million.
Wow.
It's pretty awesome.
I never would have made that connection because I've never seen an Alvin and the Chipmunks live action or CGI, whatever they've got going on.
But they're chipwrecked in this one.
I
think I went on Twitter and said something. I said something about like a Frito-Lay joke. I destroy a bag of Frito-Lays, you know, and the bag itself is chipwrecked.
Mm-hmm.
But not a big response from that. Not a big response.
Okay.
Disappointed. Kind of disappointed in our following.
I like where you're headed. I like the effort. All right. Well, let's go ahead and move on into the media consume section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching lately, any sort of TV shows or movies or concerts we've been to, pop culture stuff that we've been kind of checking out. So, Tyler, we always start with you. What have you been consuming recently?
Yeah, sure. Recently started the TV series Merlin from the BBC.
Okay.
You heard of this? Have you seen this?
No, I'm familiar with the Sam Neill version of Merlin that was on.
Yeah, it's not the Sam Neill version.
Not that, okay.
Yeah, I have seen that too. It's from BBC, I think. I don't know, it's still on TV.
Okay.
I have season one on DVD. I watched the first episode. It's kind of like Smallville, where they have all these characters, and then they're like, "Welp, might as well make up our own stuff." So Merlin's like the kid that wanders into Camelot, and Arthur's like the kid, and then there's Guinevere, and
so it's like Merlin origins, basically.
Kind of, but not like what was that movie we watched, Excalibur?
Mm-hmm.
Not like that. It's a lot more like Hercules: The Legendary Journeys.
Gotcha.
Kind of its corniness, but I love Hercules' Legendary Journey, so I'll probably dig Merlin. I've only seen the first episode, so we'll see.
Okay.
I watched Green Hornet last night, starring Seth Rogen. A lot better than I thought it'd be. I think you had some positive things to say about it when it came out.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I feel like a lot of people kind of didn't give that movie any attention or credit at all, and I think it does pretty well for a superhero movie. It's kind of a non-traditional Well, it has traditional genre elements, I feel like, but it does well at kind of subverting that at the same time. What did you think about it?
Yeah, it was a little different. I mean, it came out, what, like this time last year?
Yeah,
about,
I think early 2011, yeah.
And I wanted to go see it because I kind of like the radio series, the Green Hornet stuff. And yeah, and then watching it, you know, the script was pretty good. It was like they were like fast talking, but not like what's her name from Juno? It was
Diablo Cody.
Yeah, it wasn't that kind of dialogue, but it was kind of like like how we would talk to each other,
mm-hmm.
or how Seth Rogen would talk to his friends. So I thought that was kind of cool. And then of course there's kind of the Kato is kind of a superhero aspect, which I thought was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it a lot more than I liked Green Lantern, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
You know, I know a lot more about Green Lantern than the Green Hornet, yet I enjoyed the blockbuster movie more so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, check it out. It's not on Instant or anything. I had to get it on DVD, but I would check it out. It was pretty funny, actually. It was kind of a action comedy, kind of like Lethal Weapon was.
Yeah, that's one of those things spoiler. Where I think we've had, like, I feel like you and I have had conversations, I'm not sure whether they've been recorded on this podcast or not, about kind of Seth Rogen versus Jonah Hill is like the Apatow fat funny guy and like which one's better. And generally I feel like I tend to come down on the side of Jonah Hill in that battle. But
is there a battle?
I don't know. It's a made up battle that
is it in front of the Black Gates, Ben?
we'll get to that in a second, but that you and I, or maybe just I, came up with this battle between these guys. But okay. Anyway, yeah, I think Seth Rogen kind of pulled ahead a little bit with his work on that film. Because, yeah, like you said, he stars in it and he also wrote it or co-wrote it as well. So, yeah, good stuff.
It can't really be a fat guy match, and it can't be like a sumo wrestling match anymore because Jonah Hill is like lost.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to say close to 250 pounds. I don't know how weight works.
That sounds accurate to me.
As long as you're healthy, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I think it's unhealthier to lose all that weight and then, I don't know.
Yeah, talk to Christian Bale about that.
Talk to Tony Horton, the man behind P90X. I don't know. Also went and saw Sherlock Holmes 2.
Oh, awesome. What did you think about it?
It was really sweet.
Good, good, good. I'm glad you liked it.
The chess game at the end. I don't want to reveal anything. It's really good. I didn't rewatch the first one, but mm-hmm. I don't feel like I was missing anything because, you know, I know the dynamic. You don't really need to know. I mean, I guess they reference it a little bit, but you can, like, if you haven't seen the first one, you're like, oh, I got to wait to see the first one. You don't have to. You can just go see two, and maybe you want to do it that way because Downey Jr. and Jude Law, do a pretty good job of their roles and whatnot. So, yeah, I thought everything about it was pretty sweet.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, for me, it was way better than the first one. Like, everything that I liked about the first one was kind of improved on here, and the villain was way better. Jared Harris, who plays a character in Mad Men on AMC as Moriarty, and he was really great, I thought. And I thought they did a good job of, even though he's seemingly so much kind of older and more frail than Sherlock Holmes in the movie, they did a great job of making him seem like a legitimate arch nemesis, you know, somebody that Holmes is like actually scared to face at times, because at points maybe Moriarty is actually smarter than Holmes, you know.
Yeah, they're supposed to be intellectual equals, and I think in the original stories Holmes knows that Moriarty's either his equal or his superior, and yeah, like you said, I think he's fairly quivering in his trench coat, whether or not Moriarty can beat him out. And it's kind of cool, spoiler alert, for the final solution, which is a Holmes tale. And I just recently found this out. I thought the final solution was the last Holmes story,
mm-hmm.
where Sherlock Holmes walks, because Moriarty doesn't show up in the Holmes books until, like, he's only like a one-off character, I think, where he shows up in this last story, well, presumably the last story. The final solution, and Holmes just kind of walks up to Moriarty's house, and you see the footsteps going in, but you don't see them coming out,
mm-hmm.
which everyone kind of, or Mr. Watson, Dr. Watson, assumed that they both had killed each other.
Right.
And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was like, okay, I'm not writing anymore, but there was such a demand for it that he came back and kind of started writing about Sherlock Holmes again, so it wasn't the final
Oh, that's cool.
Final solution. But nice. I think, yeah, like Moriarty's kind of blown up into a pretty interesting character, even though maybe at the beginning he wasn't supposed to be, which
yeah,
is kind of cool.
Totally. Yeah, good stuff. All right, but what else? Anything else?
And finally, Chocolate, which we watched over the break.
Oh, yes.
Featuring the martial arts choreography of a young Supak, or whatever that guy's name is.
Panaritikrai?
Panaritikrai, that's right.
Is that actually him? The director of BKO Bangkok Knockout? Is that...
Yeah, I think he was... didn't you say he choreographed Chocolate?
Yes, you're right.
Anyway, we watched it.
Yeah, you're right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You claimed it was a lot more enjoyable than BKO. I liked it, too.
Yes, I definitely liked Chocolate a lot more than BKO. I mean, anybody who listened to the most recent episode of our podcast can tell, like, I kind of wasn't a big fan of that movie, but...
Yeah, I like BKO, but I like Chocolate, too, a lot better, so...
So, give just, like, the brief synopsis of what Chocolate is, because I think we alluded to it in our last episode, but didn't really tell people much of what it's about.
Yeah, well, it's a girl. I believe her name's Chocolate. I don't know.
It's not, but okay.
Her mom is someone who owes people money, and Chocolate's like, oh, I'm crazy. I'm going to learn karate from the kids outside.
It should be noted that...
Or Muay Thai. Sorry, not karate.
It should be noted that she's autistic. It's a big part of that.
Oh, yes, she's autistic. That's where she learns all this stuff. And so something happens, and she just goes and collects all this money using... martial arts, so yeah. There's like a lot of scenes of her just kicking ass, and that's pretty much the movie.
Yeah, it basically
is. There's a lot of like dream sequences that don't really matter, but as most martial arts are prone to do, you gotta sit through those to kind of calm down, and then it's back up to the hi-yas and such.
Yeah, and I think the action is so much better in this than it was in BKO, and I think it also plays into a little bit of what I was talking about in that previous episode, where you really only have like one or two characters to follow in the movie Chocolate, as opposed to BKO, where it spreads it so thin among, you know, 7, 8, 9 characters that you have to kind of bounce back and forth between. You actually like are, you know, somewhat kind of quasi-invested in her mission, basically, in this movie. Whereas in that last one, I didn't really care much about what was going on. So, I don't know. For me, I definitely like this movie a lot more. I think if anybody has gotten into the kind of Tony Jaa world of Muay Thai martial arts films and stuff like that, if you had to pick one over the other, I would say this is the one to go with. But that's my call on that.
The listeners believe you more than me anyway, so...
I don't know. I think we've got some pretty hardcore Tyler fans out there from some.
Well,
of those.
There's me.
Yeah, I was gonna say from some of those emails we've been getting, but and then you said it's you, so I guess I could just assume that you've been writing your own fan mail.
Strike true, Jack.
All right. Well, for me, a couple things that I wanted to mention. Number one, I should just point out that for those of you who don't know, over the break, Tyler and I had the chance to co-review all of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which was a lot of fun. I greatly enjoyed doing that. I don't know, Tyler, if you had fun doing it or if you just kind of slogged through it, but I had a blast kind of going back and rewatching all these movies, because a lot of them I hadn't seen that many times. Return of the King I'd only seen once in theaters back in 2003, so it was kind of a cool thing for me to be able to revisit this series. And you kind of spearheaded this whole review series, actually. I mean, the majority of the reviews are by you, and I just kind of add in little notes here and there. So I just wanted to give a big shout out to your work there and encourage people to check that out if they haven't had a chance to see that. It's at notjustnewmovies.com.
Yeah, it's all right. It's pretty good.
All right. A movie that I saw recently, aside from Chocolate and the Lord of the Rings trilogy, is The Departed. Tyler, have you seen this recently?
The Departed? Yeah. Yes. I've recently, maybe 3 years.
Okay, 3 years ago.
Two years.
I was kind of in that same boat. This is a movie that I liked a lot when I saw it in theaters, and I must admit, I didn't exactly understand the ending of it, and maybe one could argue that I still don't. The ending of the movie comes on so quickly. Okay, first of all, The Departed.
Spoiler.
2006 Best Picture winner from Martin Scorsese, if nobody knows what I'm talking about. Or if
plenty of years have gone by to spoil the film. So.
Multiple movies named The Departed, that's the one I'm talking about. DiCaprio, Matt Damon, Jack Nicholson, Mark Wahlberg. Anyway.
Jack Nicholson.
The kind of crux of the movie is about these two guys who are kind of, what's the way to say it? They're undercover on different sides of the law, basically. You know, you've got DiCaprio versus Matt Damon. One's an undercover cop. One's a kind of a cop who's an informant for a big mob boss and an Irish mob boss in Boston. And basically, at the end of the movie, everything gets really, really hectic and kind of chaotic in the last like 15 or 20 minutes of the film. So yeah, I'm gonna spoil some stuff here. If you haven't seen The Departed, definitely don't listen to this because it gives away a huge plot point or multiple, I guess. So
we need a spoiler
ahead.
Alert noise that yeah. we can't like a yeah. big foghorn or something, and then someone booming spoiler alert.
Yeah, maybe we could just play like the Inception Brom thing or something. All right, so point being, at the end of the movie, and Tyler, maybe if you somehow have like a eidetic memory or something, you might be able to remember exactly what I'm talking about here. But William Costigan, who's played by DiCaprio, gives Vera Farmiga's character an envelope and says, hey, check, you know, hang on to this for me. Like stuff has gone down where Matt Damon has realized that DiCaprio can kind of ID him as the mole, and he... Matt Damon deletes DiCaprio's identity as a police officer. So DiCaprio realizes this and puts together this envelope. Nobody really knows what's in it. And he hands that off to Vera Farmiga's character and says, hey, I just needed to hang on to this for me just in case something happens to me. So then he sends Matt Damon a bunch of tapes that basically reveal that Frank Costello, who is played by Jack Nicholson, has been... recording all of his conversations with Matt Damon throughout the entire film. So it kind of implicates him as the mole and will completely destroy his career. So DiCaprio says, hey, Matt Damon, meet me up on the roof of this building and we'll take care of this. So he does, and DiCaprio like holds him hostage and he's going to arrest him and turn him in. And then he gets shot when they get down to the bottom of the elevator. Just boom, headshot, doors open, done, blood spatter all over the walls. He's killed by a random guy. It doesn't matter. Three people die in the course of like 2 minutes, just headshot, headshot, headshot. It's crazy. So then a little bit of time goes by and Matt Damon returns back to his apartment and Mark Wahlberg is there, who was one of the characters that was featured on early in the movie, that kind of has been shepherding DiCaprio's undercover character. And he's got these things on his feet to cover up his tracks or whatever. And he just shoots Matt Damon in the head and walks out. And that's the end of the movie. So for me, I was like, what happened to Mark Wahlberg's character? Like on a basic point, like a plot point level, what has he been doing since he left the movie earlier on? And people, Tyler, I'm getting like super detailed here, and I know that you're probably not going to know what I'm talking about, but maybe people, I know The Departed has been on TV a lot recently, so I know people maybe have checked that out. If you have, shoot us an email. Let me know what I'm talking about here. Let me know what you think about this. I'm wondering if Vera Farmiga's character passed on whatever was in this package from DiCaprio to Mark Wahlberg's character, and that's how he knew to go to Matt Damon's apartment to shoot him in the head, or if Mark Wahlberg's character just kind of disappears from the movie for the last 40 minutes and does his own detective work to discover that Matt Damon's character was the mole. So that's just a question I'm throwing out there. Which one do you think? What do you think was in the package that DiCaprio gave Vera Farmiga? I realize that's super complicated. Forgive me for those of you who haven't seen The Departed in a long time, don't know what I'm talking about. So I just had to get that off my chest. I apologize. Moving on. Sorry about that. Uncharted 3. Tyler, have you played or seen this game? PlayStation 3?
No, I'm still in 1997 video game wise.
Okay, what are you rocking, like a Sega CD?
You know, Sonic the Hedgehog 3.
Okay, all right. Uncharted 3.
Dr. Wily's at it again.
Wait, was that his name?
Is it Dr. Wily?
No, I don't think so.
I think that was Mega Man's bad guy.
Robotnik, maybe?
Ah, Robotnik, that's okay. Right. Yeah, right. Dr. Robotnik, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so Uncharted 3 Drake's Deception came out in November of 2011, so not that long ago, and I got it for Christmas, and I actually had a chance to play it over the past few days and just beat the game outright in like 2 or 3 days. So I was really excited to play this because Uncharted 2 was previously my favorite video game of all time. It's a pretty high honor. I don't play video games that often, but this Uncharted
series... only played 6 video games ever.
The Uncharted series is my favorite in video game history, so naturally I love this third game. The only complaint I might have about it is that it kind of is a little bit too similar to the second game, and in that nothing really improves that much story wise. It's kind of a little bit of a retread of the same type of things, and and gameplay wise especially, it's almost identical. So I wish there was a little bit of advancement as far as the gameplay goes. But the story was actually really cool. It was very good. I mean, you know, this series is kind of lauded for its storytelling and how it's kind of references Indiana Jones and all these great pulp series and stuff that have come before, these action adventure movies and TV shows and comics and stuff. It's kind of inspired by all of those. And for me, this game was really cool because it kind of does feel like a movie at times, and it especially feels like Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, which is funny because this is the third entry in this franchise, and Last Crusade is the third entry in the Indiana Jones franchise. So I think that I think that there's a lot of allusions to Last Crusade here. Most notably in the beginning of the game, there's like a flashback sequence where you can play as a young Nathan Drake, who's the main character of this franchise, kind of like the opening scene of Last Crusade as a young Indiana Jones, and it shows how he kind of gets the whip and all that kind of stuff. So it's very cool. I won't go on and on and on about it.
Wait, Nathan Lane?
Nathan Drake.
Oh. I was like, that's odd.
Nathan
Lane. Why would a minigame be playing as a young Nathan Lane?
Is the star of this franchise. That would be amazing.
Like, no. You're playing the game as Nathan Drake, and then there's a flashback where you can play as Nathan Lane. He's like an optional second character.
And you're just performing in, like, high school plays and music.
Yeah, you're in, like, you're in that movie about the mouse, like, yeah. Mouse Hunt, and then... you know, other such voice acting, perhaps. You're in a booth just voice acting.
You have to press X at the right moment to get your voice at the right pitch or something. All right.
Well, it's not a game.
Well, that is Uncharted 3 Drake's Deception. It's out in stores.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Nothing. I was just going to say it's out in stores now. What were you going to say?
This week, this episode of Not Just New Movies brought to you by Uncharted 3.
Yes.
What are going to be your next video games you're going to play? Is there like a list, like Arkham Asylum 2 or Arkham City or whatever it's called?
Arkham City is on the list, but it's not going to happen for a long time. To be completely upfront, I've got a part-time job right now that's getting ready to run out in the end of January, and I'm going to be starting
a video game.
I'm going to have to start to look for work like pretty severely, really quickly. So I just wanted to knock out Uncharted 3, so it wasn't there looming and kind of distracting me from a job hunt. So if anybody wants to hire me, who's listening to this, to write freelance content for them, movie reviews and movie news and stuff.
I asked for a list of video games.
Hit me up, email me, leave us a voicemail, Twitter, whatever. That'd be great. So, all right. Well, with that, let's go ahead.
I'll hire you, Ben.
And I appreciate that. I know you will.
I'm going to hire you just to play video games.
Hey, I could do that too.
Yeah, so could I. What am I thinking?
All right. Well, let's go ahead and move on into our review of Lethal Weapon.
He's the criminal's worst nightmare. A cop who enjoys the danger.
No guns, no jiu-jitsu, just bring him down.
Do you really want to jump?
Well, then that's fine with me. Come on.
Wait a minute.
He was ready to retire. Now, he's going to wish he had.
Gun!
Raj, meet your new partner.
New partner? For this.
If these guys can just stand each other.
What you got in there?
Florian Smith.
A lot of old timers carry those.
The bad guys don't stand a chance.
Okay, so Lethal Weapon came out in 1987. It was directed by Richard Donner and written by Shane Black, starring Mel Gibson and Danny Glover as a the buddy cop duo of Martin Riggs and Roger Murtaugh. Tyler, what did you think about Lethal Weapon?
Ben, you get a smoky, dark city. You get a cop drama / comedy, and you put some jazz music behind it. It's like a sandbox for me. I will watch anything that has those three components in it. So. Yes. I gave it a 4 out of 5 stars on Netflix. I'd give it a, if we were dealing with decimals here, I'd give it a 4.2. Pretty high.
That is respectably high, yes.
Respectable. I'm a respectable reviewer.
Was this your first time seeing this movie?
I've seen bits and pieces of the series.
Mm-hmm.
I generally know a lot of the taglines, but yeah, this is the first time I've seen it in its entirety.
Okay.
We should have watched it for Christmas, but whatever.
Yeah, well, that's kind of it's interesting that we watch this in such close relation to Die Hard and Die Hard 2, because these movies also came out, you know, really close to that. This one came out in 87, Die Hard was in 88, and they're both Christmas movies, both cop movies, obviously. There's a lot of comparisons to draw between the two. I think Lethal Weapon's a little bit more of, you know, obviously it plays a little bit more on the comedy side of things. Die Hard gets, has comedic elements, but overall I'd say it's a little bit more serious. People can listen to our Die Hard episode for more discussion on that. But
Die Harder with us.
Yes, indeed. So you mentioned the score. Let's talk about that real quick. You said jazzy music and stuff. I actually was kind of doing a little bit of research about this, because for me this is like one of my favorite I guess it's one of my favorite scores, like movie scores in general. I mean, I don't have like a running official list or anything, but I'd put this, you know, up there in like my top 20 or something, maybe top 30 all time, because it's such an iconic score, and it very much represents what this series is about. You've got dueling instruments here. You've got the saxophone that kind of blows in with like these dramatic heightening kind of putting emphasis on different points that happen in the movie. Like Murtaugh will kind of shrug his shoulders and look exasperated, and the saxophone will be like, just kind of like playing up everything. And then you've got Eric Clapton, surprisingly, playing guitar on the soundtrack, or on the score as well. So that was the thing that I was like, who plays guitar? This is really well done. And I found out it was Eric Clapton, so I was kind of shocked about that.
Yeah, they said it at the beginning in the credits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, actually, I'll take the time now to mention it. Over the Christmas break, I watched Lethal Weapon 2 just because it was on TV and I hadn't seen it in a while. I had nothing really to do. And then the Apple II came up with the original Lethal Weapon for us. So I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of apropos.
Yeah, exactly. So during my viewing of Lethal Weapon 2, I wanted to check out the music and did a little research there. So I'll talk maybe a little bit, just very briefly, about the sequel near the end of this conversation, if I remember. If not, whatever. So, So Tyler, this Lethal Weapon for me kind of really embodies all of the best about the buddy cop genre, if you will, subgenre maybe. And
80s buddy cop would be a good, more specific genre.
I think overall, you know, like I think.
Oh really?
Yeah, I think.
Oh well, yeah, maybe, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, you've got like the 80s elements are definitely there in this movie, but it's kind of, I don't know, like Die Hard, I find it a little kind of it rises out of its the era in which it was made. It's kind of a timeless movie, I think, and that's why for me it kind of, when I think of buddy cop movies, this is the franchise that I think of. So I know.
I go to Rush Hour.
Okay, all right. Well, yeah, there's a little bit more of a kind of a contemporary version of one. And yeah, I mean, the list goes on for what movies are, you know, kind of fall into that buddy cop genre. Apparently, I was looking
this
up.
What's the one where Van Damme plays his twin, and they that double impact? Does that count?
I think it is, yeah, and it does.
But a buddy cop if you're playing with buddy copping with yourself.
Right, yeah. I think that's one of the more meta buddy cop films. But I was looking this up, and a movie called 48 Hours with Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy is kind of credited as one of the first buddy cop films. But back in TV, I mean, Starsky and Hutch, which I know you're a big fan of, was, you know, was kind of a television version of that. Same thing with Miami Vice to some degree. So
Turner,
you know,
and Hooch.
Turner and Hooch, yeah, okay. That's a,
what's that Eddie Murphy one? Beverly Hills Cop, the other guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Judge Reinhold and John Ashton or something, yeah.
from Animal House.
With all of that said, and for me, how well this kind of represents the buddy cop, like the best and worst of the genre, what did you think about the relationship between Riggs and Murtaugh and how their kind of buddiness, if you will, played out throughout the movie?
Yeah, I mean, I liked it because it had kind of a nice, calm feeling to it when they first kind of started hanging out with each other because, you know, we've mentioned this a million times, everything needs to be Nolanized in some way with serious tones and origin stories and such. And, you know, a lot of people, oh yeah, the whole movie, they hate each other, but then they end up liking each other at the end. When in this film, they like, you know, except for that one instance, spoiler alert, where a Riggs takes somebody off the top of a building. Mm-hmm. Other than that, they were pretty much on the same level, kind of understood each other. And, generally, some good buddy cop films like Turner and Hooch, where they just don't understand each other until the very end in Lethal Weapon. Because, of course, Ben, if you haven't seen Turner and Hooch, one of them is a dog.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
But in Lethal Weapon, they kind of understand each other from the beginning. So that's kind of nice to see that, you know, that kind of dynamic throughout the whole film. And I'm sure in the sequels, there's some touch and go where they don't understand each other with this specific instance. But in Lethal Weapon, it's pretty cut and dry where it's, you know, two guys against the world.
Yeah, I think
I
was surprised because I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but it's been a long time since I've seen it. I think I was most surprised with how quickly their relationship kind of they come to that understanding you were talking about. And I think it really does. It hinges around that scene that you mentioned where Riggs takes the guy off the building, because after Murtaugh kind of blows up at him and realizes like how serious Riggs's like mental state is. And it's kind of an interesting character, Riggs. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think after they kind of have it out right there in that little side room, they both kind of realize like, okay, you know, we're not going to spend the rest of this movie like completely at odds like we do, you know, we are operating on kind of the same wavelength here. So, I think that's a great point that you bring up. You know, it's not like they're battling everyone else and each other for the whole movie. And then only at the end do they kind of high five and that's it. Like, yeah, sequel time. It's like that kind of understanding comes into play a lot earlier in this film. So, what did you think about Mel Gibson's performance, first of all, and then the character of Martin Riggs? It's kind of an untraditional character, you know, somebody who's dealing with some pretty serious stuff.
I mean, he's pretty gosh darn insane in this. He's not a Scientologist, is he? Is he just crazy? Crazy in a sense that he has, like, anger management issues.
Right, that you're talking about Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson, yes. Not Danny Glover or Donald Glover. Who am I talking about?
Mel Gibson,
yeah. And, you know, I generally like the things he does. He gets kind of off the rails once in a while, but whatever. He's dealing with his celebrityism as much as we can hope for. But I really didn't have a problem. I mean, I knew Riggs was crazy when I was coming into the movie, and he was dealing with some serious issues. But when you're a cop on the streets, Ben, you got to deal with that stuff. I mean, he sees this kind of stuff every day, and he can't let it eat him up on sight, or he's not going to be able to succeed in the force like he does with, like, Murtaugh.
Right.
So that's my textbook answer. I really don't have anything else to add on to that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, like, I think we've mentioned this as well. Do you have a problem watching movies with actors that have been embroiled in kind of off the, like, behind the scenes, like, public meltdowns and things of that sort, you know, like maybe with Tom Cruise and stuff? Can you watch Tom Cruise movies in the same way now that you could back then? Same thing. I mean, obviously we're talking about Mel Gibson here, but
are you talking about like Legend, like Tom Cruise's performance in Legend?
I mean, I wasn't specifically getting at that, but,
No, I mean, celebrities will do whatever they want, and that's kind of, well, I don't know why that is, but that's what happens. It's when they try to brainwash us that I don't really appreciate them, okay. And I think that's kind of what I associate with Tom Cruise and Will Smith and guys in the
Scientology business. You know, and brainwashing is not a thing I dig, because generally people are susceptible to that kind of stuff. And if you know that and do it anyway, that's kind of the greater evil.
Yeah, so I mean,
I try not to support. You know, I try not to support that unless I am the brainwasher. Then of course go and do what I want you to do. But other than that, I mean,
yeah, I mean,
yeah, I don't. I mean, if you're just if you're just shooting your mouth off for no good reason, you're not really, you know, trying to enslave anybody. I mean, I'll watch your movies.
I mean,
just don't try to enslave the human race.
Yeah, I think what the point that we're both maybe trying to make is that we don't necessarily endorse any of Mel Gibson's beliefs and kind of off-camera behavior in any way.
Is it the anti-Semitic comments that you're referring to?
Yeah, there's a lot of that, and like he yelled at his girlfriend a couple years ago, and I think there was like abuse allegations and stuff. I don't know. I'm just saying,
a guy isn't allowed to yell at his girlfriend?
What actually happened is immaterial. I'm just saying, I was asking you on a level of like, are you able to separate that kind of stuff from your music?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Experience? Okay. Because for me, it's like, you know, this is my favorite Mel Gibson role, hands down. This character and maybe even this first movie out of all of the Lethal Weapon franchise. And I don't know, it's like I've seen him in recent stuff, and it's a little bit more difficult for me to separate that kind of stuff. I like to try to separate that as much as I can, but at the same time, it's like there's only so much you can do to kind of color your perceptions in one way after seeing a very public meltdown like the ones that these guys have had before. So
he's Mad Max, dude. Come on.
Yeah,
you gotta come a little slack.
All right.
I think he slayed Tina Turner at one point in Return to Thunderdome.
I have not seen that one, but
oh, that's a shame.
I'll believe you. So conversely, what did you think about Danny Glover's performance and the character of Roger Murtaugh?
Murtaugh? Yeah, he shouldn't have shaved his beard.
I think it's a silent G or a soft G on the end. I think you're saying
Murtaugh.
No, I think it's Murtaugh. Just to throw
really?
It out there. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Murtaugh with no
Murtaugh?
G. No.
Like eggnog, Murtaugh?
No. You know what? Go ahead. Go with it. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts on Murtaugh is he had that beard at the beginning that was really sweet.
Yep.
When for some reason his family surprises him while he's in the bathtub.
Yep.
Which is kind of an odd thing to do. And not only that, but they reach to hug him too.
Yeah, it's very odd.
And the guy's just chilling like in a bathtub. And it wasn't a bubble bath, people. This was, I mean, there were a few bubbles maybe, but not enough to
relatively clear water.
Yeah, like, and the family's just like, what up? Happy birthday. Couldn't have waited till you got downstairs. We got to hug you while you're in the bathtub.
Yeah, it was strange.
And Murtaugh's like, what the hell's going on here? Yeah, I guess I'll hug you guys. You know, this is weird. Like, he was the only one that thought it was kind of weird. Birthday Cake should have gone into the bathtub. That would have been hilarious.
Yep.
Step it up, Donner. But other than that, no, I'm just kidding. Other than that one main point. Yeah, I mean, he's not as troubled as Riggs.
Mm-hmm.
He's just, you know, he's like a freaking Carl Winslow from Die Hard. He was just like, I haven't had any trouble for 50 years while I've been on the force. And this one day, Riggs, you come in and you mess everything up.
Yeah.
It was my last day before retirement.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I was going to bring up. Like that, you know,
please only refer to him as Carl Winslow if you have to.
No, I'm talking
Murtaugh
about
Murtaugh and Winslow. The
are
new this, series
are now the same person, is what that
no, no, they're the new buddy cop because Mel Gibson he doesn't want to work. He's working on Apocalypto too.
Lethal Weapon 5, Murtaugh and Winslow. I like it.
Yes, we did that.
That's kind of the thing is like
Urkel.
He's not Roger Murtaugh is not close to retirement yet in this movie. It's only his 50th birthday, but that's a big cliche that you find in these buddy cop movies. It's like, oh, this guy's only got one more day before retirement, and then the hot-headed crazy guy comes in and now he's his partner and he just turns everything upside down. Blah, blah, blah. And I mean, you see a lot of these cliches happening in Lethal Weapon, but for me,
They're not cliches yet.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of where, I'm not going to say it's where this stuff originated, but it's where it was like made its mainstream kind of peak, you know, before it was like too much. Before they really became cliches. So
it's like this podcast. I mean, we didn't invent podcasting, but we popularized it.
Sure. Yeah. I'll go with that. I mean, it's interesting because in later movies, Murtaugh does plan to retire, and then, you know, that's like the catalyst for their adventure is like, oh, we've got to do this one more thing before I retire, that kind of stuff. But it's interesting to know that that's not the case for this first movie in the franchise. But I thought Danny Glover did a really great job here, and Mel Gibson too. I didn't really talk much about what I thought about his performance, but yeah, both these guys, I mean, it's like I said, the kind of prototypical buddy cop performance in my mind. And I think both of them played up their specific aspects, you know, incredibly well. The movie's a lot of fun. There's a lot of quick dialogue and kind of ridiculous jokes and stuff back and forth. Like we were talking about the scene where Riggs takes the guys off the building, and right before he goes up there, Murtaugh kind of gives him this pep talk and tells him, you know, don't kill anybody, don't do anything crazy, just like bring him down safely. And then Riggs is like, Roger. And Murtaugh's like, what? And he's like, 10-4, you know, the confusion because his name is actually Roger. You know, there's a lot of that kind of quick dialogue. There's one point where that was really stupid. This line that you may have written down or heard, Tyler, where they're escaping from this, like, you know, dank, dripping underground torture facility late in the movie. And Murtaugh says something.
In the back of a Kmart.
Sure, yeah. Murtaugh says something, or Riggs says something about, like, what did the shepherd say to the sheep? Let's get the flock out of here, or something like that. Did you get that? It was really quick. It's like almost under their breath. Like they say a lot of these kind of stupid jokes as they're going around. So, but the movie doesn't like rely on that, as it doesn't wait around for the audience to laugh at those things. It just kind of says them in stride and keeps on going. Like the pacing is really great, I thought.
My favorite one was when they were rolling up to the house to shoot somebody. There was a prostitute or something at this house, and they're just like, the camera's in the back of the car, and they're driving up the driveway, and he's like, I think I saw this house on the Lives of the Rich and Shameless or something.
Yeah.
They just got out of the car right away.
Yeah. So what did you think about, like, on a plot level, like the story itself? Were you kind of invested in it? Did you, you know, being that this was your first time seeing it, I'm interested in what you thought about the story.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you get those aspects of Smoky City, jazz music, and cops, and any real story is, if it's new, if it hasn't been rehashed, even if it has been rehashed, I'll watch it. Didn't really have a problem with it, the drugs, the nom, you know, secret CIA.
Shadow company.
Military group. I mean, yeah, it's kind of the badass stuff that I go and watch movies for, so... thumbs up all around there. There wasn't really anything that was left loose, like no loose ends or anything, which is always good. But yeah, nothing really out of the ordinary. What was it, like FX kind of reminded me of FX. Wasn't there drugs involved in FX1? I can't even remember now.
I think it was a mafia thing. It was like a witness protection deal.
Oh yeah, I think you're right. But, so I guess nothing really to do with FX, but it reminded me a little bit of it.
But you just wanted to mention FX because Brian Brown is Australian.
Brian Brown.
Mel Gibson.
No, I think Mel Gibson was born in California, but then he grew up in Australia.
Oh, okay, that could be true.
I don't think he's straight up Australian. I've heard that. Okay. You may want to fact check that.
Yeah, I'll look that up a little later.
Or just believe me because I'm brainwashing everybody.
Sure, yeah, I'll buy it. Yeah, he's American, born in New York. All right. So you're talking about the war aspects and stuff. That's something that I really liked about this movie, the kind of the mythology of Martin Riggs, the character, as they kind of paint him throughout the movie. You're slowly privy to a little bit more and more of what he's going through and what he's been through, especially. And I really like the scene after Riggs goes to Murtaugh's house to eat dinner with the family, and they're outside and Riggs is getting ready to leave, and he talks about how when he was 19 years old, he made he killed a guy from 1,000 yards out in high winds, and only like, you know, 7 or 10 guys in the world could have made that shot. and you can just see, like, in Murtaugh's eyes, like, oh, man, this dude is freaking, like, he's serious. And the problem, the only problem with setting up a character as he's amazing at any one thing is when he doesn't do that one thing every single time throughout the whole rest of the movie, you kind of doubt why they brought it up in the first place. So if they set up Riggs as this amazing shot and it, you know, as an amazing marksman, I should say. And there's also that sequence in the shooting range where he shoots the smiley face on the thing from, you know, however many yards away. If they
1,000.
Sure, yeah, we'll call it that. 1,000-yard shooting range, that makes sense. If they have him as this guy who is, like, essentially Superman with a gun when it comes to it, why, when the helicopters come in and kill Michael Hunsaker in the house, can't Riggs hit Mr. Joshua hanging out of the helicopter shooting
people?
You know, like, yeah. You know, there's a couple little things like that where it just doesn't quite add up. But overall, I think, you know, those things are pretty negligible.
I think it's Hunsaker, like hard, hard G, Hunsaker.
Okay. All right. I think you're being vulgar, but
much vulgar.
So what did you think about the family, like bringing the family into it? You know, you got,
well, with your cop movie, you're always going to get the family involved. I mean, that's part of being on the force, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
One of the downsides. Oh yeah, definitely, because you have a family and you want to have the family, but you also want to be on the force.
Mm-hmm.
And the two are never separate. I mean, yeah. You're going to have some overlap when these bad guys, you know, they whip open a phone book and they go, okay, there's the only one Murtaugh in Los Angeles. I'm going to go to that guy's house and kidnap his daughter. So, spoiler. So, I mean, generally, this is the kind of stuff that happens. It's the kind of stuff that moves the story along.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no problem with it.
Okay. What did you think about Donner's direction, the kind of like stylistic, just like the whole look of the movie and kind of the action elements and stuff like that? Did you think it was?
It didn't look like Superman, I'll tell you that much.
Okay.
It was a lot darker. Man, you're really catching me off guard here. I really don't have an answer for that, but no complaints. No complaints from this side of this corner of the ring.
Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, there's a couple things like, the helicopter sequence out in the middle of the desert I thought was done really well, and kind of established that space as this really desolate terrain that there's, you know, no one even anywhere remotely close to this area. Thought that whole scene went down really well, and there's a lot of cool stuff.
Isn't
there.
Isn't that Nevada or like close to Las Vegas or something? Could that be out there?
It says the El Mirage Lake Bed. Let me look this up. It says,
I think Sammy Hagar drove past that when he was claiming that he can't drive 55.
Okay, that may be true. This says
might have been the same desert.
This says it's the Mojave Desert of San Bernardino County, California. So it's not that far off.
Yeah, you know, like, what used to take 5 hours now takes all day.
Right. Now you're just quoting, I can't drive 55. I take this seriously. So
it is in California?
Yes, it is. Yeah. And, you know, I thought that was really well done. I think the whole like Hollywood Boulevard chase shootout thing was done really well at the end. And there's a scene even in Murtaugh's house where they're kind of bathed in the red light of these Christmas decorations and stuff where he's like, we're going to get bloody on this one, Roger. Like it's going to be serious.
Oh yeah. That was a cool scene.
Yeah.
I dug that.
I guess bringing up the Christmas thing too, it's like, what did you think about the Christmas element in this movie? Cause it wasn't really, I guess, overbearing.
No, definitely wasn't. It wasn't like they were like beating guys up in a mall while Christmas shoppers are walking around. It wasn't in your face about it. It was I just kind of like that little aspect.
Yeah,
kind of like in Die Hard where it's not up in your face either. It's not like he's using like a Santa Claus as a shield, a human shield or anything. It's just kind of the setting, like it's a small facet of the setting that kind of puts a story at a certain time of the year. And, you know, they can release it at Christmas time and whatnot. But it really, yeah, like you're saying, it really doesn't have anything to do with the film.
Yeah, definitely. So
I liked it set at Christmas time.
Yeah, yeah. I think it, you know, it kind of adds, this is something that Shane Black, the writer, does often with his movies. I think I don't know how many movies he's written. Let me take a look here. Looks like One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, and I think four of them were set around Christmas time. So Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is another one that we're talking about, kind of untraditional Christmas movie, non-traditional Christmas movies, in our Die Hard episode, and that was one that I didn't mention. I'm a big fan of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I don't know. Have you seen that one with Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr.?
No.
Oh, man.
Were they gay together?
They're not gay together. That's a really, really great film. You got to check that one out, dude. It's like one of my favorites. The dialogue is really, really awesome. It's also written by...
Same guy that wrote In Bruges?
No, it's written and directed by Shane Black, who's the same guy that wrote Lethal Weapon. And interesting. Shane Black, apparently, I was looking this up. He wrote Lethal Weapon when he was 23 years old.
Nice.
Which is, yeah, pretty astounding. This guy, if you're not familiar with his work, he wrote The Monster Squad, Lethal Weapon, Lethal Weapon 2, The Last Boy Scout, Last Action Hero, and a movie called The Long Kiss Goodnight with, what was her name, Gina Davis, I think, yes? Yeah, Gina Davis, and Samuel L. Jackson. And Shane Black, at this point, was the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood history because he made $4 million for the script of The Long Kiss Goodnight. That was in 96, and that was like, you know, a record. Nobody had ever made that. It was insane. So people were like going nuts about that back in the day.
What are we doing here podcasting? We should just be writing scripts.
Yeah, seriously. I'm a big Shane Black fan, and for those of you who are fans of the Marvel series of films that are going on right now, he's actually going to be directing Iron Man 3 that comes out next year in 2013. So I think
they're making a third one?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
My brother. What did we not see in the second one?
I don't know. I wasn't a big fan of Iron Man 2. You can check that
review
out.
There better be like a Thor v. Iron Man movie.
Yeah, I'm not
That'd
sure.
Be cool.
We'll see. So, Tyler, apparently I was catching you off guard with my questions earlier. What did you have written down as things that you wanted to discuss about?
I had one thing written down.
Okay.
I need to travel exclusively by helicopter.
Okay.
Because that helicopter just carried... Was it carrying Gary Busey or just anybody?
I think it was mostly Busey, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like Gary Busey was just like, you know what, I'm not going to sneak into this place. I'm just going to helicopter down everywhere I go. And you know, balls out. So that's what I wrote down. I mean, I really didn't. I enjoyed watching the film, and there wasn't any criticisms or. I mean, I guess the whole movie was a highlight for me, so I didn't really write down highlights either.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm kind of the simpleton to this week.
All right.
I enjoyed the movie.
You brought up Gary Busey. What did you think about him as Mr. Joshua, this kind of like psychopath ex special forces enforcer guy?
Yeah, I mean, I've always liked when he was the Rocket on
Rookie of the Year.
Yeah. And I used to go to school with a kid named... Oh, never mind. Okay, that's the wrong guy.
Were you going to say Chet Stedman? Because that
no,
was his
no, because you had mentioned Nick Nolte, and for some reason I get Gary Busey and Nick Nolte confused sometimes.
Oh, that's not an uncommon thing. That happens all the time.
So I went to school with a kid named Nick Nolte, and he was kind of a Gary Busey character, which I think the confusion began with. And... One time I was in the grocery store, and there was a picture under manager of the week or manager of the month, and it was a picture of this kid, Nick Nolte, and we were in like third grade, and I don't remember, this is something that stands out in my mind. So to get back to Gary Busey, though.
Okay.
Gary Busey, was this before or after? Because he had a real bad motorcycle accident, and that's what a lot of people think he kind of... His synchronization is out of whack because he was in a motorcycle accident. He got his head got really messed up, and those teeth that he had, that he's famous for, like his real big teeth, like those are fake because all his real teeth were shattered in this motorcycle accident.
I'm looking this up right now. This happened in 1988, so this was the year after Lethal Weapon. Wow. The accident happened.
Yeah, because I thought this was kind of a calm, not too crazy Busey, which we're kind of used to now. And, yeah, I try not to make fun of him too much because he has been in a major accident. And,
I had no idea about that.
He's, you know, he's just kind of kooky. He's not dangerous.
Right.
But he is in this movie, though, as Mr. Joshua. And
well,
I thought he was a stone-cold killer in this. So props and the badass fight that they have at the end is pretty awesome because
I like action movies where people just bust each other open.
Yeah, that made no sense though. Like,
no, it really didn't.
I'm glad you brought that up. There's like the whole movie comes to a head when Mr. Joshua busts into Murtaugh's house and tries to murder everyone there, presumably. Right. And then Riggs, like, puts a gun to his head, walks him out in the middle of the front yard after, yeah, you know, with conveniently a car has run into a freaking fire hydrant. So water is spraying everywhere and it looks all cinematic and ridiculous. And they just, like, brawl, like, mud wrestle in the middle of the lawn. And, you know, it's seemingly hundreds, but probably only, like, 10 or 12 cop cars pull up. And Murtaugh's like holding everyone back on the force, and he's like,
"Hold up, I'm in charge of this. This is my property. I'm responsible for this man brawl."
And then, you know, they cut to the inside of one of the cop cars, and it's like,
"He's right. Murtaugh's in charge on the scene until the watch commander shows up." It's like,
"I've contacted LAPD. This is all kosher. Let's roll."
It's so ridiculous. He's like, "He killed two of our guys. Let Riggs take him out on my own front lawn." It's
and like, the guy's like, the cop that he was holding back was like, "Oh, okay." you mean Carl and George over there, those guys sitting around by the fire hydrant,
seemingly the worst cops ever,
illegally parked near a fire hydrant,
who are just sitting there and on the lookout for suspicious characters by Murtaugh's house. And when he comes rolling up in slow, you know, at like 2 miles an hour, they don't suspect that this blonde guy with dimples that they've been, you know, clearly there's an APB out on him at this point. They're like, "Hey, what can we do for you, buddy?" And he just shoots him in the face. It's
you
like,
want a donut?
Well, you guys probably deserve that. But,
I do not endorse Ben's comments.
Okay.
He's the Mel Gibson of this episode.
Oh, ouch. But I thought,
about that. Oh yeah, that adds to your point about like the Riggs mythos, mm-hmm, where they may have come across each other before in Nam, and this was the final showdown.
Yeah, or if not like personally, then definitely like their own kind of histories are being played out here.
In the novelization, so
yeah, all right. Well, you know, there's not really a, like you said, you know, the movie's pretty straightforward. It's a, you know, an action comedy buddy cop film. There's not really a lot to really chew on as far as like beneath the surface, like, you know, deeper meaning type of stuff.
Yeah,
but there's one scene at the end, like they, I keep bringing it back to Die Hard, but they when Riggs takes down Mr. Joshua on the front lawn, he's just like laying there sprawled out, and Riggs, like shirtless and wet, rolls up in, you know, under Murtaugh's arm, and they're like in the same coat, basically, like two men becoming one. It's really weird. And then in slow motion again, just mimicking like what happens in Die Hard. I guess technically this happened first, since Die Hard came the year after, precursor to what happened in Die Hard. Anyway, Mr. Joshua just rises up and he pulls a gun, and then Riggs and Murtaugh spin and shoot with the same arm. Like, they both shoot him in the chest at the same time in super slow motion. And it's like, you know, there's not a ton to latch onto in this movie, but I think the unity of these guys and kind of what you talked about before of like, yeah, they're not really against each other and stuff like that. That's a good kind of physical representation of what their mental states are near the end of the film, I think. But, you know, it's not really
romance.
It's a total bromance, but
it's Holmes Watson for the 80s.
Yeah, there you go. Definitely.
Except Watson is a badass.
So I wanted to, I'm not really going to talk about Lethal Weapon 2. Maybe we'll do a podcast on that one day. So I'll just leave it.
Will our podcast episodes have sequels to them? That'd be cool.
Maybe. Yeah, we could be like, this is welcome to episode 192. This is a sequel to episode 72. So
yeah,
go way back and listen to that one.
I'm still banking on Trancers 2 podcast.
That might happen. I'm just saying.
It should happen. Those letters we've been getting.
The Trancers and Dollman episode.
You keep throwing out.
Clearly one of our most listened episodes.
It's true, actually.
I don't think that's true at all.
I think it's up there. It's in the top five, I think.
I think you're sorely mistaken. But, so
I guess that's pretty much all I had to bring up with Lethal Weapon.
Did you like Lethal Weapon 2?
Lethal Weapon 2 is good. I think I like this one a little bit more. You've got the introduction of Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon 2, and he's kind of a mainstay for the rest of the series. But I personally would have been a little bit more interested in seeing what Riggs and Murtaugh by themselves would have had to do with a whole nother movie before, like, maybe introduce Pesci in the third one or something. But that's just me. I don't know. So
next Shane Black.
It maybe. Instead of playing the traditional Apple II noise before we pull the Apple II, I've got a voice clip here. This is my favorite thing that Gary Busey has ever said, and I just want to play this, and then right after that we'll announce what movie we're watching next week. So here we go.
If you put that straitjacket on me, I'm going to pull your endocrine system out of your body and make a hat out of it.
And make a hat out of it. Now, you know that's deadly, right? Because the endocrine system is like a series of glands
it's not possible.
Throughout the body.
I don't think it's possible to be actually removed from your body.
If anyone could do it, Gary Busey could.
Medically, I don't think it's possible. But
you're not a doctor.
Why don't you go ahead and tell people what we're going to be watching next week?
All right, so for next week, we'll be watching The Towering Inferno.
Man, that is old school.
Oh, is it?
Mid-70s, I think, yeah.
Okay, all right.
It's got, like, Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway and who? Paul Newman, maybe? Some big-time people in there, so, yeah, maybe...
Salad dressing guy?
Newman's Own, that's the one. All right, well, if you guys would like to watch along with us, The Towering Inferno is actually available right now, streaming on Netflix. Watch instantly. You can email us, let us know what you think about that, or Lethal Weapon, or any movie that we've talked about, or any podcast about
Die Hard.
The show in general, pretty much anything, and we'll read
Trancers.
Here. Die Hard and Trancers especially. You can email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566. If you do, you might sound something like this.
Not those new movies. Paul Carlson from Enid, Oklahoma. Go Cowboys. National championship, kind of. All right, I want to talk to you guys about the Lethal Weapon series. I know you guys are talking about it. One of my favorite series. All right, I'm going to start out with a joke right now. Lethal Weapon, isn't that kind of redundant because all weapons are lethal, right? All right, joke time over. Now we're going to talk about the movie, the first movie, Lethal Weapon. He's going up against some Chechens with Danny Glover or Donald Glover. I don't know, and there's a scene in the bathtub. It's pretty good. Lethal Weapon 2, don't really remember too much about that movie, but I think some of the same stuff kind of happens there. Lethal Weapon 3, Kelly LeBrock and Sigourney Weaver in that one too. Doing some martial arts, maybe. Lethal Weapon 4, Joe Pesci talks about a frog in that movie on his bike, and it is really sad. Lethal Weapon 5 is going to be great. That's the series in a nutshell, and it's, I hope you guys agree with me on that one. Furthermore, I got a question for Tyler. It's a sports question. What do you think about Reggie Miller coming back? Playing some fantasy. I need him on my team. I need him on my team. Tyler, tell me. All right, I got a business question for Pat. Pat, would you invest, just off the top of your head, I know all these investment IRAs and Roth questions come, and, you know, or just when you hear them, it goes off like a light bulb in your head, you hear boom. All right, 16 and pregnant, the restaurant. What do you think? Is there money there? Please get back to me. My name's Carl Carlson, eat in Oklahoma. Call me back.
Man, that is a passionate individual there. I'm not really sure why he asks you and Pat, who's no longer hosting this show, a question, but yeah. fails to ask me anything. I'm taking
Pat,
that
Pat
personally.
Pat hosts in spirit, so.
He does host in spirit. Well, thanks for the
guy right now, Ben.
Thanks for the voicemail, and we actually have another voicemail this week. Let's take a listen.
Well, hello, Not Just New Movies Podcast. This is Jim Napier of the Popcast Podcast, and I just wanted to say hello and Happy New Year. But more importantly, I wanted to share with you my thoughts on the wonderful films known as Lethal Weapon. They truly are, my favorite action comedy franchise. All of the Lethal Weapon, even the one with with Chris Rock was not bad. But, you know, just the characters with Danny Glover and Mel Gibson together on screen, you know, the first one is really good. It's more action than comedy, but it's still a great, great film. Lethal Weapon is awesome. There's nothing better than seeing Gibson take on the bad guy at the very end, and I'm forgetting his name, but anyway, Gary Busey, that's right, Gary Busey. Gary Busey and Gibson fighting on the front lawn. Definitely a memorable scene, and it's a great Christmas movie, too. There you go. Take it easy.
Oh, yeah, Jim, always good to hear from that guy from the podcast at screeninvasion.com, I believe the site is.
Yep.
Nice.
Seth Cohort at Geek Tyrant, and he also was a...
more your cohort than the mine.
What?
He's more your cohort than mine.
Right. And he also apparently is a fan of the big kind of brawl sequence on the lawn at the end, so...
Oh, yeah, you know. Yeah.
Iconic indeed. All right. Well, people can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Leave us a review. Check us out on Facebook. We're on Twitter, twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. Got a couple new followers, I think. Let me check this real quick.
Yeah, we have an email, right?
Yeah, I'm reading it. That's what I'm pulling up is our email right now. Okay. Oh, here we go. So the two new Twitter followers we have are at Old Game Reviewer and at Madrid MV. So thanks for the follows there. And then we have one email. I asked people about their favorite movies of 2011, and Dark Aguirre responds, "Tough one, but I would have to say Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2." Interesting choice for favorite movie of the year. I think a lot of people are big fans of that movie, myself included. Favorite of the year? I don't know. If you guys are interested in my favorite of the year, you can go to notjustnewmovies.com and find it there. Of 2011, of course. Tyler, what do you have any thoughts on Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows as a potential favorite movie of the year, or what your favorite movie of 2011 was?
Oh, nice. Nice question. 2011?
Yeah.
I don't even remember what came out.
It's only 8 days ago.
Good one. Yeah, I'm gonna throw my hat out there and say Thor.
Thor. Movie?
Yeah, I really liked Thor. I don't know why. That was pretty good.
All right. Well, thanks for the email. And yeah, good stuff. All right, so we already finished up the character name game. That was good. Got that out of the way. And let's go ahead and just go back and forth and tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet this week. Tyler, let's start with you.
Yeah, you can find my stuff at the Solar Sentinel. I run the Not Just New Movies Twitter. Other than that, I'll be popping in and out like Gary Busey in your front door. So
there you go.
Watch out.
And don't forget to check out the Lord of the Rings reviews that Tyler kind of
started. Yeah.
And Not Just
I saw a lot of people doing marathons of those movies, so...
Yeah, it's a
maybe it's time for you to go marathon them up and then read our reviews.
Yeah, I mean,
not you personally, you the audience,
right? The understood you.
This isn't a private conversation, folks.
So, yeah, it's I think the break, the you know any sort of long break like that, you know, has its advantages and it gives people a lot of time to catch up on movies and stuff like that. So. It's good for us, good for Lord of the Rings fans. You guys can track me down on Twitter, twitter.com/BenPears. You can find me writing at geektimer.com, filmonic.com, where I'm going to be increasing my output in 2012, notjustnewmovies.com, and you can hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly Podcast. Music for this episode comes courtesy of the Lethal Weapon score. This is going to be the Hollywood Boulevard Chase little segment, and Michael Kamen, Eric Clapton, and David Sanborn did the score. We talked about it briefly, but I really like the music a lot in this film. So, good stuff there. Well, Tyler, thanks for joining for the first podcast of 2012. This is going to be a good year for us, man.
All right, I dig your enthusiasm.
All right.
We'll eventually learn to share it.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll see y'all next week.